Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Amir Amirani. He's the director-producer of We Are Many, the never-but-told story of the largest demonstration in human history and how the movement created by a small band of activists changed the world. He's a filmmaker with a strong track record for some of the most respected series of the BBC. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So what is We Are Many and what is its history?
Yes, well, We Are Many is the story of a protest that happened worldwide on the 15th of February 2003. It was the first ever global protest and probably the first ever protest that happened before a war started to try and prevent it happening. It took place in a little short of 800 cities in 72 countries. And some estimates say it was 15 million people and some say as far as 30 million people around the world trying to stop the war. And so it's down in history as the largest mobilization of people in history. I happened to be on that protest in Berlin in 2003. I was at the Berlin Film Festival and taking part in it. And I knew that this protest was in the air. And of course, we were all aware that the Iraq war was, you know, looming. When the festival finished in Berlin, I was trying to work out whether to join the protest there or to come back here to London where I live. And I went on it in Berlin, and looking back now, I realize it was probably my first ever big protest, and it was huge, about 500,000 people. When I came back to London, I noticed that a lot of my friends who I did not associate as being either political or protest types were really excited and talked about the protest in a really excited way, which really surprised me. And then my own reaction to that was interesting because I felt very sad that I had missed a historic day in the history of my city. And I put those together and I thought, okay, something's very interesting is going on here and something has sort of shifted, because in London, 2 million people had protested. It was the biggest protest in the history of this country. You know, nobody that I knew could ever remember anything like it. And it wasn't the usual suspects. It was people from every walk of life had come out on it. And something in my gut told me that this would portend something. I didn't really know what it symbolized or what it signified, but it stayed with me for a couple more years and I kept kind of occasionally coming back to research it. And I remember one day I was standing in the BBC making a radio program and I suddenly stopped and thought, well, this feels like it was probably the biggest protest ever. And wouldn't that be an interesting subject to excavate for a documentary? You know, it was something that I was genuinely curious about. How did it come about? Who organized it? How did it spread worldwide? How did it become so big? What, if any, impact did it have? And ultimately, I suppose the big question is, what does it mean? And so that's how I came to the idea of making it, you know, around 2005. And in 2006, I dipped my toe in the water by doing some interviews to see what the story was like. And I liked what I was hearing enough to realize that it was a film that I wanted to make. And in the end, it took me 9 years to make it. And in that process, I went from wanting to make it to kind of feeling like I needed to make it, because it felt like a really important story that needed to be told and recorded for posterity. And so that is the story of We Are Many.
So there were a whole bunch of directions I wanted to go as you were speaking, but I'm going to, for now, stick with something you said right near the end. So why precisely is this a story that needed to be told? I mean, apart from, or in addition to, just historical interest.
Sure. Well, I suppose for a number of reasons. One is that it's unusual in television or film, and, you know, in that world to, for you to see films that are about, you know, quote unquote, ordinary people. You know, you don't see too many films about protests. The idea of making a film from the kind of bottom up, that talks about what people on the street feel. I haven't seen too many films about that. And when you watch the news or you watch general documentaries, you see the world from the point of view of usually men in suits, usually white men in suits, who are either politicians or generals. And I wasn't interested in that story. I wanted to know what it meant when the biggest, you know, group of people in history on one day come out to protest against a war. So that's why I felt it was needed. And because I thought that that particular angle, was worth, focusing on. And also because I wanted to make sure that in years to come, there was a record of this, of the global nature of that protest, so that no journalist, no commentator, no academic could say that the war was unopposed or could downplay the scale of the protest. And so that, you know, it would be a document, a historical document, about that moment. Because you know what happens with these things, you know, it can be spun, there can be propaganda, and people will use statistics to try and downplay it and say, I mean, it still happens occasionally here. They'll say, well, you know, there was such and such a poll that showed actually that this percentage of people were for the war. You know, what's that phrase? There's lies, damned lies and statistics. So anyway, I felt that over and above it being a good story, was that it needed to be recorded, for posterity and for the point of view of the people.
So again, I have a bazillion questions. I'm going to throw out a couple, three things, and you can just take this whichever one of those directions you want. One of them is I love what you were saying about making sure there was a record of those who opposed. And it makes me think of Henning von Treskow, who was one of the members of the German military in World War II who plotted against Hitler. Mm-hmm. And after D-Day, a lot of the plotters wanted to quit because it's like, it's clear the war's over. And so why are we going to risk our lives in order to just hasten the end of this horrible regime? Uh-huh. And Treskow's answer was absolutely not. We have to go on, not only because there are, you know, X number of civilians being murdered every day, but uh-huh. also because we need to show to history that there were some people in Germany who were decent and who opposed this.
Uh-huh.
And so I love the resonance between what von Treskow said and what you're saying here about we need to show that there's a record. We need to show to history that somebody cared.
Yeah.
That's one thing. Another thing is early on when you were describing it, you said that they were able to mobilize all of these people, you know, millions of people. And two things about that. One is, that's an extraordinary logistical achievement. So can you talk about that? But the other is, mm-hmm. I'm so glad you used the word mobilize, because years ago I did an interview about Arab Spring with mm-hmm. Ramzi Kanaan. And one of the things that Ramzi Kanaan said is that there is a big difference between mobilizing and organizing.
Right.
And so, okay, I'm just going to dump that stew in your lap and you can do whatever you want with any of it.
Okay. Well, so what's interesting about that mobilization, and we can talk about the distinction between organizing and mobilizing, but that mobilization in 2003 is that it was pre-social media. I think pretty much the only digital technology that was around was was email. And, you know, good old fashioned meetings and face to face meetings and, telephones and leaflets and so on. So, you know, the idea seemed to have arisen in London, and in the documentary, I interview, those activists that sort of came up with the idea. Then we trace the idea, to some meetings that happened in sort of Barcelona, then Florence at the European Social Forum, where they all got together in a disused sort of railway siding. And then the next thing that happened, which we don't include in the film, but it was at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre in Brazil. And then it sort of just, you know, by this stage, it had become global, this wave, and people from all over the world were talking to each other and organizing. And in a way, it became much bigger than anything the organizers ever imagined, or ever could have imagined. It just surprised all of them. Somehow, you know, the stars aligned, and this thing became huge. So it was, you know, I think in the film, one of the organizers in New York, Leslie Kagan from United for Peace and Justice, talks about how they distributed probably over a million pieces of, you know, literature, the kind of leaflets and God knows what else. So it was a combination of old technology and new technology, but only in the sense of email, nothing, no social media. So, you know, people, millions and millions of people around the world were mobilized by organizers, and these organizers were very, you know, experienced, decades-long veterans of social movements, who, I guess, you know, were experts at it. I mean, I marvel at what they did. I am not an activist. I'm a filmmaker who happened to take part in a protest and was, you know, sufficiently moved by it and interested in it that I decided to make a film about it. I would no way count myself as an activist. Would that I had those, you know, chops. But it is, you know, when I've seen what they do in all fields of activism, you know, when everybody else is out doing their thing, you know, on a cold Tuesday night in some hall somewhere, there'll be activists meeting and organizing and doing all they need to do to bring about social change, whether it is through protests or meetings or publications or lectures. You know, it's remarkable, really. But as I say, February 15th, 2003, the Iraq war protest became bigger than any of them ever imagined it would be.
So I want to go a different direction for a moment. And can you talk about the film itself and how we'll get more to this later, but how people can watch it? And I mean, I hate to use such vulgar language, but sort of, can you sell the film itself as opposed to selling the I'm sorry if the term sell offends you, as opposed to selling the protests?
Of course. So, so the film has its, has a website called wearemany.com. And so you can watch We Are Many on through streaming or, at the moment streaming. so we had the North American premiere on the 21st of September, and it consists of musical performances at the beginning and at the end. And of course there was the film and a Q&A with an amazing panel hosted by, moderated by Stephen Kinzer. And so that is available at least for another week. And it's what happened was we partnered with various theaters, around 40 theaters in the US and Canada, and also around 40 organizations, peace and justice organizations who partnered with us, and we created links for them. So anybody who wants to watch can either look up on the website and find the theater they want to support and purchase their ticket through that theater, or look up the organization they'd like to support and purchase the theater ticket through that particular link. And by early next year, we hope to be on all the digital platforms, Amazon and Google Play and all the rest of them. So in the meantime, the best source is to go onto wearemany.com to watch the film. And the presentation, the full presentation is available. And that should be the case for the next few months, I hope.
So you said you came to this as a journalist more than an activist. What did you learn about, if we look at this not so much for the history, but for lessons moving forward, what did you learn, and or what do you hope that listeners, watchers learn?
Well, there are a number of takeaways, for me. The first thing is that obviously the protest, I knew before the film started that of course the protest didn't stop the war, although it's doubtful now looking back with what we know that it could ever have stopped the war, because the decision had been made in advance, well in advance, that the war was going to go ahead. But what happened with the protest was that a lot of social changes happened, because a lot of people were turned off politics because they had a faith in democracy. They thought that if they came out in such large numbers, that it would mean something to politicians, and that the politicians would pay attention. When, for example, in the UK, the biggest protest in the history of this country ever happened, 2 million people come. And of course, for every one of those 2 million people, there'd be at least five or more who shared those views but couldn't come because they were either working that day, or they were maybe ill, or maybe elderly, or looking after kids, or whatever. So it was a huge, huge number of people that opposed that war, not just in the UK, but of course in many countries. In the United States, I think around 200. I'd say 200 cities, big and small, in North America took part in that protest. And as I said, 800 cities around the world. So when that many people come out, and of course, those are not your usual suspects. It can't be on those numbers. Then they see that the war goes ahead. A lot of people question what their democracies are about and what's going on. So people got turned off. Some people became turned on to other things. They said, well, okay, if traditional electoral politics is going to be like this, then maybe we should investigate other things, other forms of protest, other protest movements. A lot of young people became politicized and radicalized and went on into different movements. Some people turned off from politics altogether. So it was a really, for a lot of people, it was a very visible demonstration of the disconnect between people and the governments in charge. And that was dramatic and it was damaging. And I think we are living all over the world with the repercussions of that, that loss of faith, loss of trust. So then the question comes, well, when you look at that, what are the alternatives? Is in the bag of tools that are open to people, you know, there's of course protests. There will always be a place for protest. But the question that hangs over it for a lot of people is what's more? You know, I think Bill Fletcher in the film says, you know, when you've done one or two big protests, then what do you do? You know, and I think the question remains, I think for a lot of people, for example, in the, again, in the United Kingdom, people thought, well, what if the, you know, unions and workers had called a general strike in advance and brought the country to a standstill? Could that have worked? Would that have worked? Would that have worked in the United States? I mean, the UK and the US were the two main protagonists in the war. Of course, there was also Aznar in Spain. So these are all, you know, interesting questions. You know, could people have taken part in nonviolent direct action, or some kind of civil disobedience? Years later, we would end up seeing in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, people who occupied Tahrir Square for 18 days. They didn't just turn up for one day. They did it for weeks and ultimately overthrew Mubarak, even though a couple of years later there was a counter-revolution and the military took power again. But, you know, it was maybe two steps forward, one step back. But so in a sense, what I learned in the film, in making the film, were all these different sides to the protest. And I'd like to think that when people watch the film, they will draw their own conclusions about, what the protest meant to them, and, what the future, you know, what we might, as what people might do in future if faced with another war. So, you know, there's now Donald Trump is beating the drums of war with Iran. You know, were that to become a more hot threat, what would happen? Would there be another protest? Would there be another protest on that scale? Or would people do things differently? These are all interesting, you know, questions. But I would say that I found out recently that the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement and slogan, the, you know, three women, Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, and Opel Tometi, they were interviewed a few years ago, and the interviewer asked one of them, you know, what movement or event in their life had inspired their work. And Patrice Cullors referred to the 2003 Iraq, anti-Iraq war movement. And she said that she was 19 at the time. It was her first protest and that had really inspired her. So, you know, and also the current head of the current executive, excuse me, the current executive director of Move On, a woman called Rana Epting, who is half Iranian and half African American. When she became executive director recently, wrote an article in which she talked about the roots of her activism. She was a student in 2003 and had received an email from Move On saying, come out on a protest. And she went out and was so struck by it, by the energy and by seeing other people who shared her views, that it completely transformed her. And she said that set her off on a road of a life in political activism, such that she eventually became the executive director of Move On. So the reason I mention those two is that protests don't have just their impact for good or ill at the time when the event takes place, but that it can have multiple ripple effects, years or decades down the line in ways that are unexpected and unforeseen. So I think that we will live with the ramifications of the war for a long time, and we will live with the ramifications of the protest for a long time. And both of those are really fascinating.
So early on, you talked about how this film is, is very interested in the opinions of people who participated in the protests, and at the same time, you've talked about the importance of organizers, and you have a list of quite extraordinary people who are in the film: Noam Chomsky, Ron Kovic, Medea Benjamin, Bill Fletcher Jr., John Le Carre, Danny Glover, Brian Eno. And so can you talk about the marriage? And you've also talked about the importance of, you know, long-term organizers. Can you talk about that marriage of experience and, I don't know what other word to use, inexperience? Go ahead and take this however you want.
You mean experience in terms of the organizers and inexperience in terms of the cast list of well-known people that you mentioned?
No. I mean the experience. I'm including Noam Chomsky as among the experienced, or Medea Benjamin as among the experienced, or Ron Kovic. They're all experience. What I'm talking about is that you had said that one of the things you wanted to capture was the sort of perspective of the person on the street.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Mm-hmm. And so can you talk about the different roles, or, I mean, I found that really intriguing. Can you take this anywhere you want?
I got it. Yeah. So I would say the subject of the film is the mass action of the, you know, millions of people. My friend, who's also the American producer of the film, Amy Humes in Brooklyn, she said she was struck by the fact that We Are Many is a film about millions of people. So it is a film about millions of people told through a cast of characters who you mentioned. I mean, I did 110 interviews in 7 countries, and 54 of them or so are in the film. And they range from, you know, organizers, to well-known people like, you know, Brian Eno and John Le Carre and Danny Glover and so on. Now, the way I looked at it was, I wanted everybody I interviewed to have some connection to February 15th, 2003 and that protest. So either they were organizers and were involved in the planning, or they were these high profile, you know, you quote unquote celebrities who also took part in it. And in the end, I also included any politicians that I could find to ask them about their connection to it, in the sense of asking them, when you saw such an enormous protest, what did you think? Did it not give you pause for thought? So they were all connected to that global mass action of the people. And I wanted to sort of tell the narrative through their eyes. And of course, there are in the film, I also did interview a number of actual protesters on the street. So in a way, the millions of people on the streets are a character in their own right. I mean, the film is about what they did. And then there's this kind of cast of characters who in a way narrate that day. And that's how I wanted to try and, achieve the goal of telling the story of, you know, millions of people.
So that's great. Thank you. And through all of this, you know, and you really made the point well about, how this was a huge demonstration, but the and series of demonstrations, but the war went on anyway. Oh, I also want to mention another thing, which is I live in a tiny little town, Crescent City, California, population, I don't know, 4,000 to 8,000 or something. And we had protests here. So I'm wondering if the 200 cities in the United States is low, because there have to be, I mean, there have to be many, many cities that are this small that still have their contingent show up.
I'm totally right. I would say that probably you have to double that number. It could be maybe as many as 400 cities and towns, because there is an animated sequence in the film where we, you know, these kind of little points of light on the globe light up, showing the sites of the demonstrations. And I'm sure we probably underestimated by quite a lot, certainly in North America. Yeah, there would probably be loads of places, like Crescent City, where, you know, tens, maybe a few hundred would come out, and maybe that was just never reported. You know, the mainstream media are not the best at reporting, at the best of times, the number of people who come out on demonstrations, or they always they underplay them. But it's great to know that it happened in Crescent City. Maybe they'll watch it, and that'd be great.
So when you were talking about this, and saying that, you know, it was tremendously successful in one sense and not in another, I was thinking of two quotes that I want to put out. One of them is by the corporate anthropologist Jane Ann Morris, and she has written, "Corporate persons have constitutional rights to due process and equal protection that human persons, affected citizens, don't have. For non-corporate human citizens, there's a democracy theme park where we can pull levers on voting machines and talk into microphones at hearings, but don't worry, they're not connected to anything and nobody's listening except for us." Mm. And then the other quote is from Thomas Lindsay, who used to run or co-run the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And one of the things that they would do is they would give citizens the rules, the tools of democracy to, for example, prohibit a corporate hog farm in their community or a big box store or fracking. And they have done great work, and yet all of their work violates the oh gosh, I can't think of the term right now. It's the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which makes it so the regulating interstate and international commerce is kept to the federal government and not localities. So a locality cannot prohibit a transnational corporation from putting in some atrocity. And I asked him one time, so why are you wasting everybody's time? You know, you're giving them these tools, but then it's going to get struck down as unconstitutional every single time. Why are you doing it? And he said, because there is no better way to radicalize people than to give them if they believe we live in a democracy, to give them the tools of democracy, to help them use those tools, and then to have them be crushed.
Mm.
And, you know, as you were telling this whole story, and yes. before you told this story, you know, when I was watching the film, and also just when it happened in real time back in 2003, I kept thinking of all this, that it is a really good way to radicalize a lot of people. So take this any direction you want.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, first the Jane Ann Morris talking about the democracy theme park. That's something I'm going to remember. Well, yes, you know, I mean, you know, it's reached a point where it reminds me of a phrase a politician here used once about how describing a government here as being like an elected dictatorship. And, you know, whatever we think of the merits or demerits of that, the question of us becoming, you know, democracy theme parks and, you know, pulling the levers and nobody listening is very interesting. And you'd be forgiven for thinking that that's an accurate description of the countries, you know, we're living in, because there's just such a disconnect between what politicians say and what they promise and then ultimately what they do. You know, in the UK now, we're living through that with our own Trump, and the question of, you know, Brexit and, you know, they're just the how they're laying waste to the country. You in the United States are experiencing that as well in during the, you know, pandemic, which tends to expose, you know, these kinds of crises generally tend to expose the inner workings of these theme parks. So, you know, and as regards, what Thomas Lindsay said about, you know, giving people the tools for them to use, it's another way, of exposing to people through direct experience the inner workings of the machinery of government and states. And what better way, you know, for people to learn, you know, it's experiential rather than intellectual. And that's really what happened in 2003. I remember, you know, on our website, we invite people to tell their memories of that day and what it meant to them. And there's a tab that says, I was there. I think we've got about 400 stories now. Hopefully in the, you know, through the US, we'll get more. People would write in really moving stories. They'd say, well, you know, we got on the bus at 4 a.m. just to get down to London, and we were, you know, our hearts were swelling to bursting point. And then we got to London and we saw a sea of humanity, and, you know, they were filled with this real sense of optimism that yes, when they see this, there is no way they can go to war. And these would not have been your hardened, you know, radical people. These would have been just your, you know, average, politically maybe neutral, or, you know, not politically massively engaged. But anyway, they came and then they went home, and they saw that it was reported and the scale of it wasn't well reported. And then of course the war happened, and it would have been cognitive dissonance on a scale that they had never been seen before. And that was experiential, is exactly what Thomas Lindsay would have said. They would have seen with their own eyes the scale of the protest and how the worldview that they had had up to that point, the faith that they had in the system and the politicians, completely shattered. And I don't think this country has recovered from that. And so that's those two people that you mentioned are on the money.
So, okay, I'm going to ask this question in a kind of offensive way, and I'm not meaning it offensively. I'm meaning it. I think it's a real question in some ways. It's like, okay, so what if literally millions of people protest? I mean, why should the government actually listen to them? I mean, they're not experts on foreign policy. I'm going inside the mind of Tony Blair, which is a scary place, but, yep. You know, it's like, I have studied this. I have been in politics my entire life. I know what they're doing there. I know they're doing terrible things. You know, I don't know, whatever the rationale is. Uh-huh. And so what if a whole bunch of people disagree with me? They elected me in order to make these tough decisions. And, you know, there have been, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but we can probably come up with a lot of examples where, Hitler was one of the reasons that they had to assassinate Hitler when the plots to attempt to assassinate him is he was still, even though they were losing the war and even though he was doing these terrible things, he was still pretty popular.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the great line from Henrik Ibsen's play, An Enemy of the People, where at one point the guy who's trying to do the right thing for the community says the people are always wrong. And the point he's making there is that the character in the play is going against a tanning factory. I'm going against – because the river's polluted, he's saying we can't make a spa. And that's going to harm the economy, which makes everybody mad. And living here where I do in the Northwest – I know there have been masses of people come out to promote increased logging, which is ecologically really harmful. So why should the government listen to people? Maybe sometimes the people are wrong.
Well, maybe sometimes the people are wrong. But let's go back to basics. When, you know, what do governments do, or what do political parties do in the lead up to elections? I mean, what are elections? Elections are an appeal to the people. Parties set out their stall and their policies, and they say, we want your vote. It matters what you think. But when we elect governments, we don't say, well, we elect you, and then we're going to check our brains in, and then we'll see you in 4 years, 5 years time, whatever. It's not a license to do anything they want. But more importantly, there is implicit in the electoral process and in the democratic act, a social contract. And the social contract does not involve us giving them a mandate to do anything they want, and nor is there a mandate to say that you can then abuse that and lie. Lying is not part of the social contract. You know, the whole question of the social contract between the public and the government is an important one, which governments and people like Tony Blair, who misunderstand that process, abuse. They, you know, in their debased view of politics, they think that politics is about what they think and believe. I mean, if you listen to Tony Blair, he says, I did what I believed was right. I mean, going to war is the gravest act that a government can take. It's not the same as deciding what color to paint the doors of Parliament, you know. It's or whether to put 1p on the price of alcohol for tax, you know. Where the government might say, well, that's, you don't need to worry your pretty little heads because we've got teams of people that do that. Deciding to go to war is a special category. Even if it wasn't, which it is, there is, you know, a social contract involved. And so it does matter what people think. I'm not saying that therefore, you know, we should have rule by protest or rule by, you know, referenda. But certainly on the question of going to war, I mean, there are entire, you know, categories of international law, international humanitarian law, and laws of war that govern these things. It's not something that one man and a handful of people gathered together can decide on the part of the people. There used to be War Powers Acts that, in America, Congress has to sort of approve. But all of these things, you know, in the United Kingdom, Blair assumed to himself the right to declare war. Now, they did put it to Parliament, and that has now become a convention now. But unfortunately, even that was abused because Tony Blair variously cajoled and bullied and bribed in all sorts of ways politicians who, you know, I think 411 MPs in the British Parliament voted for war. And Jeremy Corbyn says in the film, he says those people knowingly voted for lies that ended up killing hundreds of thousands and, well, now over a million people. Why? Because, you know, their jobs were more important to them than the lives of people thousands of miles away. They wanted to, you know, they wanted the promotion that Blair promised them, or they wanted, you know, they thought paying their mortgage was more important than people living, you know, elsewhere. So to those people who say, why does it matter what, you know, people on the streets think? Well, for all those reasons, it you know, it matters. And after all, what were they saying? They were saying, don't rush to war. And there was no case for war. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And the case was exposed as lies. Even at the time, there was a dossier that became known as the Dodgy Dossier. In fact, in the UK, there were two Dodgy Dossiers. And nobody believed it. We now know through all the books that have been written and all the leaks and so on that, all the intelligence agencies knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. This was a case that was constructed. In fact, I was just reading today that, we know that the decision to go to war was made, in the pretty soon after George Bush came to power. And if you read, I think it's Paul O'Neill's book. This idea that the war was based on some moral basis that, to do with weapons of mass destruction and a threat and so on. I mean, it's hogwash. But it is important on an issue of war that at least you have to pause to listen to what people are saying. And of course, we're now living with the consequences of it. 17 years later, we're still in Iraq. We're still in Afghanistan. Syria is burning. The whole Middle East is on fire. Because those two people, and of course, and the people around them, decided to go on this criminal, murderous war when millions of people around the world warned about the consequences and wanted that not to happen.
So thank you for that. And I hope that it was clear that my question was pretty much rhetorical, and I don't agree with what I was asking.
No, I know, but I wanted to give it a full considered answer. Rhetorical or not, I think it deserved a full answer.
I think it's a huge question, and it made me think of a couple things. One of them is that Woodrow Wilson in the United States ran on a peace platform, keeping us out of World War I, and changed his mind, or he thought it was lying. Mm-hmm. And so the point is, had he run on a campaign of, I'm going to get us in World War I, he probably wouldn't have been elected.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could say the same thing about Tony Blair, that had he said, hey, I'm going to go invade, you know, that then we would probably be having a somewhat different discussion or a somewhat different protest.
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting. But when you with someone like Tony Blair, you know, it's easy to get tied up in knots and expose his hypocrisy, because he you probably haven't heard him talk about Brexit. But he's often rehabilitated in the media here by being given a platform and columns and interviews and so on. And he talks about how, you know, the people have spoken. You know, he talks about the current government. He says, listen to the people. The people don't want, you know, what Brexit. Well, that's interesting. It's the same Tony Blair who basically described the protesters as having blood on their hands because they were trying to stop a war. He didn't think that he should listen to the protesters then. I mean, if you look at the film, he tries to compare the protesters to saying, you know, well, if there's half a million protesters, that's less than the people that Saddam Hussein has killed. If there's a million protesters, that's less than the people that Saddam Hussein killed in the war with Iran, omitting to mention that Britain and America supported and armed Saddam Hussein when he, you know, launched that war on Iran, or omitting to say that Saddam Hussein was our ally when he was, you know, murdering his own people. Aside from, you know, that hypocrisy, that was not what the people were saying. You know, you can chew and walk, you know, you can chew gum and walk at the same time. You can say that you don't support Saddam Hussein at the same time as saying launching an illegal, murderous, immoral war based on lies is also, you know, wrong. But we don't elect sophisticated intellectuals to be leaders, and Tony Blair wasn't one of those. So this is the problem that we have with these kinds of leaders, unfortunately.
So we're running out of time, and thank you for everything you've said. And can you briefly return us to how to find out more about your film again, and B, answer anything that you wanted to say that I didn't give you the chance to say?
With the film, is called We Are Many, and they can go to wearemany.com, wherever you are, and try to find the link to watch the film. In due course, we're going to put other links on streaming links. We're just working on a Vimeo on demand link. And in due course, in the early next year, it'll be on all the digital platforms like Amazon Prime and Google Play and so on and so on. People can go and if they want to contact me, they can email me at info@wearemany.com. So that's info@wearemany.com. And I'd love to hear, you know, people's thoughts and comments on the film. And then aside from that, is there anything that there's so much to say, and we don't want to bore the listeners. So I think we've covered quite a lot of interesting, you know, material. I guess really what I would leave people with the thought is that every small action matters, no matter how small, no matter if it's just one person meeting another person somewhere to discuss an idea, you know, whether it's to do with peace or organizing or whatever it is, it all adds up. That's what I saw, you know, in the film, in making the film. And ultimately it's just about people, I suppose, expanding their awareness and understanding. And I was, you know, very privileged to be able to tell this story of this huge historic mobilization of people. And I hope that when people watch it, they'll take something positive from it, and, you know, incorporate it maybe in some way in their lives. But I'm just glad to have this opportunity to talk to you about it. I hope it's been interesting.
Oh, it's been fabulous. And thank you so much for your work in the world. And Thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Amir Amirani. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio and the Progressive Radio Network.